Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Controversy over the publication of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad continued to roil much of the Muslim world. Here's some of today's news. President Bush called on governments to stop the violence, and protesters took to the streets in Pakistan, Bangladesh, in Indian-controlled Kashmir, and in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, police shot and killed four protesters marching on a U.S. military base. A U.S. military spokesperson says the U.S. and other countries are now investigating whether extremist groups are inciting rioters. Elsewhere, a satirical news magazine in France became the latest to display the cartoons, plus a few more based on a variety of religions. Online, the Arab European League posted a cartoon depicting Hitler in bed with Anne Frank, citing the right of artistic expression. Also today, listeners to NPR's Morning Edition heard from the leading Danish imam, Ahmed Abu Laban, who led the campaign to bring the published cartoons, and some even more derogatory cartoons that weren't published, to the attention of Arab government leaders in the Middle East. When he was questioned as to whether he had, in fact, provoked the current violence, this was his response.
Do we denounce any act of violence in Islam, and according to the genuine Sharia interpretation, it's only the cartoonist, the editor-in-chief, and the newspaper. They are our group whom we should initiate dialogue. So nobody should inflict it by any harm whatsoever. To make damage to the property and to set fire to the embassies is counterproductive to our issue.
For a deeper look at the controversy, we're joined first by Nasser Kadar, a member of the Danish Parliament for the Social Liberal Party, which, by the way, is in opposition to the current government in Denmark. He's leading a group of Muslim moderates trying to quell the controversy. Welcome, Mr. Kadar.
Thank you.
And in your opinion, in sending those cartoons, including ones that hadn't been published by the Danish newspaper, to Arab nations, was Imam Laban in part responsible for provoking the current violence?
Yes, he was. He was a part of the delegation. He sent the delegation to three Muslim countries because the cartoons was made 4 months ago, and nobody reacted. But when the Muslim delegation was sent by Abu Laban to the Muslim country, the whole fire started. And because the Arabic news satellite channel took this news on the headlines.
Well, what about the Jutland Posten's newspaper in Denmark, where you are, which first published these pictures in September, they said, in response to being told that they could not find an illustrator who would write an editorial cartoon regarding Muslims and Muhammad. Today, the culture editor of Jutland Posten newspaper says, "I do not regret publishing those photographs. I think it's like asking a rape victim if she regrets wearing a short skirt at a discotheque."
You know, what Jyllands-Posten did is not illegal in Denmark. It's about ethic and moral. It's not illegal. And if you don't like those cartoons, you can go to court. That's what the Prime Minister and others said. And I think those few Muslims who have been very angry, instead of going to Middle East, they should go to the court and sue the Jyllands-Posten, and then the court will decide if it was right or wrong. But they went to the Middle East, and now we have an international conflict. It is a Danish problem. It is a Danish newspaper. Those are Danish Muslims. We should have solved this problem in Denmark.
Well, and now we have, as you said, this huge conflict. What do you think is happening here, Nasser Kadar? Do you think this is a clash of civilizations, you know, over use, over images of religion and freedom of speech?
No, I don't think so. But we have some people, we have some groups who want clash of civilizations. We have Islamists that are interested in this. But the majority of the Muslims in Denmark don't want this. The majority of Muslims in Denmark think it's silly cartoons, but the life must go on. let's look forward.
So you think this is a deliberate attempt on extremists on both sides of the equation to provoke a clash?
Yeah, I think some extremists want clash, they want conflict, they want enemies, but we are a majority who don't want conflict. And now it seems as like everything is out of the Danish control. What's happening in the Muslim world are out of the Danish control, and it's because you have many other interests and agenda going on.
Well, here we have calls, and including one today from President Bush, who's calling on governments to stop the violence.
Yeah, because I think it's very necessary that the government in the Muslim world stop this violence. Because some people have said that that's because the Muslims are discriminated in Denmark and the Western Europe. But those demonstrations and the violence is not in Western Europe and Denmark. We don't have demonstrations in Denmark. All is happening in the Middle East.
But do you think that those governments can stop this violence? And how much of a role do Muslim leaders have to play?
If they, there's a will, they can. Because it's not that, it's a few thousands, a few hundreds who's out in the streets. The majority have not yet taken any position to these cartoons.
Well, we know that you are part of a group of Muslim moderates in Denmark trying to do something to, you know, send out a separate image and also maybe stop this
violence. Yeah, we have been in different Arabic televisions and radio and newspaper and have sent a message. We want this to stop. Enough is enough. The life must go on. What they do in the streets of Middle East now is very bad for Islam and the Muslims.
Well, you spoke about this being, you know, about some extremists, but what about what some say are the root problems? And let's just address one of them. What do you think of the criticism of the more extreme Muslim communities in Europe that don't seem to want to integrate, instead have a goal of forcing their belief system on the European population? Do you think that is an issue and that it needs to be addressed?
You know, those few Islamists, extremists, they want the other. They want to be the spokespersons for the Muslims in Europe. You know what's going on in Denmark now is between Abu Laban and other imams is a fight about the Muslim souls. All the imams, you know, in Denmark we have 100 imams. Mm. Just five have been out in every media and saying they are against those cartoons. But the last 90 imams have not said anything. And it's because there's a fight between the imams. Who's going to be Mr. Islam in the future?
Mm. Nasser Khader, a member of the Danish Parliament for the Social Liberal Party. He's speaking to us from Denmark. And we're joined now by Joe Jaffe, the editor and publisher of the German newsweekly Die Zeit, which last week decided to publish one of the cartoons. And Joe, I know you've been listening, and Nasser Khader has said that the cartoons did not bother him and other moderates as much as obviously they bothered many others. But still, do you regret your decision to publish the cartoons, given what's happened?
Certainly not. Because obviously we don't want to be like these thousands or hundreds of thousands of Muslims who are demonstrating against something they have never seen, because they mustn't. They're not allowed to see it. It was extremely important to know what this was all about, and so we published one of them. And we certainly don't regret it. I thought it was our obligation to do so.
Well, it's interesting you say that, you know, you published it for for educational purposes. Here in the U.S., very few outlets have published the photographs. In fact, your Washington bureau chief wrote an op-ed in yesterday's Washington Post defending your decision and criticizing those who didn't. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, I was taken aback by this, the Bush administration, the State Department, doing what the U.S. normally accuses the Europeans of, being mealy-mouthed and weak-kneed and cowardly and appeasement-oriented. I was really surprised that a nation that has so much pushing for democracy and freedom in the rest of the world should be among the first ones to take this apologetic position.
Do you think, Joe, that this is a moment in time that had to happen, that this had to sort of be aired?
Yes, yes, it had to happen, but in a different way than I think you think. We've looked at the flames that went up across the Islamic world, and in most cases, it's very hard to distinguish between justified disgust against the violation of religious sensibilities and hard-headed national political interests. Look at Syria. The government has been fanning these flames because it had its payback time for Syria against the UN, which is investigating the murder of a Lebanese premier, against the United States, which is putting pressure on them, on the Syrians. It's certainly in the interest of Iran, which has found a nice way to deflect attention from the nuclear crisis it has unleashed in the world. And so you can go through much of the list. In that respect, once you accept my theory here that this is politically motivated strife and upheaval, then there was a certain kind of necessity involved, because all these various nations that I've listed have an interest in fanning these flames.
And we have also spoken on this program about people who objected on the basis of sheer religious beliefs. Do you accept that there is, at least some of that?
Look, you take a country. I mean, I'm sure there are similar laws all over the European Union. But take Germany, for instance. We have laws which involve, even jail sentences for blasphemy, for insulting anybody's religion, whether it's a Christian or Jewish or Muslim, whatever. But after 500 years, after we used to murder each other by the millions for the sake of the one and only God, we now do it differently. We go to court. We sue. And we let the courts, not self-justice, decide whether somebody has been insulted and whether somebody should be punished. And I think that is a very critical difference, which we call it the West, has to stand by and cannot... You can't just let, even if they were justly feel violated in their sensibilities, to take the law in their own hands.
Joe Jaffe, editor and publisher of the German newsweekly Die Zeit, which last week published one of the caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. And this note, Fleming Rose, the Danish editor who first commissioned the cartoons for his Danish newspaper, repeated on CNN that he did not regret publishing them last September, and he offered to publish any cartoons about the Holocaust, now being drawn as part of an Iranian newspaper contest. The Iranian paper Hamshahri said it's holding the contest to test the Western claim of freedom of expression. Well, just ahead, a closer look at that new study that says low-fat diets don't prevent heart disease and cancer. Question, which low-fat, good or bad? And later, it's cute when you club hop in your 20s, not so cute when you're in your 50s. Author Jay McInerney on growing up. Much more ahead here and now. Now, a revolutionary new study claims that eating less fat does not cut the risk of cancer or heart disease in women. The 8-year, $415 million study followed 49,000 women, and the results debunk decades of conventional wisdom that sparked an entire industry of low-fat foods. The Women's Health Initiative conducted the trials, and the results were published in the Journal of the American Medical Association today. But before you break open the Oreos, possibly the best way to eat them, we're going to take a look at this study with Dr. Eric Rimm of the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Rimm, welcome.
Thank you.
I have to say right off the top, I read this headline and I said, that can't be true. It can't be true that low fat isn't better for you. So start by telling us, how did the Women's Health Initiative go about this study?
Well, as you mentioned, it really was a monumental study in that the size of the study and the cost of the study. They randomized almost 50,000 women either to a low-fat diet or just their regular diet. And in the low-fat diet, during the first year of the study, they actually met with them 18 times to give them advice on how to eat low-fat diets. Every 3 months, they would bring them back in and make sure they're doing okay and give them more advice. So it was just advice. They didn't actually give them the food. And so people that were in the low-fat diet, they just told them how to eat. They didn't actually give them the food. And people in the control diet were just told they're in a study, but they weren't necessarily told that they should change their diet. To get into the study, you had to eat at least 32% of calories from fat. So there weren't any very low-fat diet people that were recruited into the study.
Right. And again, the low-fat people had probably a lot of brown rice, maybe, or low-fat yogurt.
Well, that's one thing we don't necessarily know all the details of. They were told how to eat, to have more fruits and vegetables and how to eat more whole grains and how to have a low-fat diet. But there are many different ways to have a low-fat diet. Like you said, you can have low-fat or non-fat yogurt, but that has a lot of high fructose corn syrup in it. So that wouldn't necessarily be healthy food, but according to this diet, since it was low-fat, it would, it would be something that would put in the low-fat group. And I think that's what went wrong with this study, or what even the investigators say, that there's a lot of different ways to get at a low-fat diet. So,
and when you say investigators say something went wrong, do you believe that? What's your view of this study? Is it definitive, or do you think it has some holes in it?
In some ways, we knew this 10 or 15 years ago before this study started. There was lots of observational studies that suggested that the amount of fat in the diet is not that important. The thing that's most important is the amount of saturated fat and the amount of trans fat. And they did get some indication in this study that those people that had lower saturated and trans fat actually did have some benefit.
And remind us again this distinction between good fat and bad fat.
The good fats would be those that are vegetable oils, mono and polyunsaturated fats. And the bad fats would be the saturated fat or the trans fats. And the trans fats are those that come from hydrogenated vegetable oils, and that you can see on the ingredient list when you buy a food, or now it's actually on the food label, it says trans fat. So the trans and saturated fats that you'd get from high-fat dairy products or some beef products, those would not be as healthy, where the mono and polys are healthy, but were essentially taken out of these diets because they were told to eat low-fat diets.
So, in fact, maybe this study is a little misleading. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, I think it was a little misguided to begin with, unfortunately. I think the results are quite straightforward. Low-fat diets are not beneficial for colon cancer, breast cancer, and heart disease. I think if they had focused on lowering saturated and trans and keeping moderate amounts of mono and poly, then I think they would have found benefit. In fact, there have been several other studies that have shown just that, that if you have a diet that's moderate in fat, that's higher in the good fats, you actually do see benefit.
And one of the reasons that people think this is true is that the observation of people in Asian countries who consume far less fat than Americans and have lower rates of breast and colorectal cancer and heart disease. And so that's led to this thinking that low-fat diets are good for us.
Yeah, I think that is part of it. However, again, you have to look at what else is in the diet. It's a low-fat diet in the U.S. Can be constructed very differently than a low-fat diet in Asian countries. Plus, that was mostly based on historical information when most of the population was very, very physically active as part of their lifestyle. Now, unfortunately, Asian countries have caught up with Western lifestyles where they're eating more like our diets and they're becoming very overweight, and rates of diabetes are even growing more exponentially in Asia than they are in the U.S.
So, Doctor, I just want to make sure we're hearing you clear. Do you think if this trial, this long 8-year trial, had randomized people to diets that were low in saturated and trans fats but moderate in mono and poly fats, made the distinction between the good and the bad fats, there would have been positive results? In other words, it would have shown that the good fats actually do at least put off heart disease?
Yeah, and in fact, they say that in their results. It's sort of a secondary analysis. Once you have the big results, then you start to say, gee, there's got to be some nugget in here. And in fact, that's what they did find, is that if you lowered the bad fats, there was some benefit.
Do you worry, too, that people are just going to see that headline? Because, boy, as someone who loves her Oreos, that's a headline I want to see.
I do worry, because we've been banging our fists for 15 years saying some fat is good, and it's slowly making it into dogma. But you're right, because for so many years, people just thought low fat was good, and some of it was driven into our heads by industry and by commercials and by constantly seeing low fat foods on shelves. And so it may take a long time to unteach the U.S. public.
Well, but I'm saying, you know, you might be happy because this sort of, you know, brings back the idea that some fat is good. But I'm wondering if people are going to look at that headline and say, hey, fat doesn't matter.
Well, hopefully they'll listen to your show. but yes, I, of course, I mean, all kidding aside, I do worry because that is the headline that I saw this morning in the New York Times and the Boston Globe is that, gee, low-fat diets aren't beneficial. And
fat doesn't matter.
Yeah, you know, we do have to be more careful about the fats we choose.
Dr. Eric Rim of the Harvard School of Public Health cautioning it's not yet time to break out the Oreos just because of this study. Dr. Rim, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Butter, I remember butter. We were once like lovers. We're quite a team.
Oh, well. Tomorrow on Here and Now. Is coal the new oil, despite some of the recent headlines? We'll hear from the governor of Montana. He says yes. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now.
Oh, but what a dream. I remember coffee-flavored Argonauts sweetening my lips. Now it's just a
funding for Here and Now. Security is being tightened across Iraq during a Shiite festival, which reaches its climax tomorrow. The festival marks the 7th century death of the Shiite saint Imam Hussein. But violence remains a daily occurrence in Iraq. Iraq's higher education minister, a Shiite, survived an assassination attempt in Baghdad today. Yesterday, gunmen killed a Sunni community leader in Fallujah. And earlier this week, 4 U.S. Marines were killed in roadside bombings. 3 of those Marines were part of the 22nd Marine Expeditionary Unit in the city of Heat, about 90 miles west of Baghdad. Washington Post reporter Nelson Hernandez was embedded with that unit. He's now back in Baghdad. And Nelson, the 3 Marines who were killed, they were just about to go home. What happened?
These Marines were part of a convoy that was making a routine pickup from another base in the city, and they ran across some kind of massive explosion. When I spoke to the commander of the 22nd Marine Expeditionary Unit, he said that it wasn't clear yet what had caused the explosion, but that it was large enough to perhaps have destroyed a tank.
Yeah. And in one of those weird contrasts of war, we understand many other members of the unit found out about it after they stayed up late to watch the Super Bowl on Sunday night.
That's correct. I was actually watching the pregame show with some of the Marines when a few men walked into our tent and said that 5 Marines had been injured and that they were unconscious. But it didn't really become clear to me that they were dead until the next morning.
And we understand you were with another group of Marines from that unit when it was also attacked last week. What happened there?
That was also a routine mission. We were going to deliver food, a hot dinner of beef stew and vegetables, to another base in the city. And I was in the last vehicle of the five Humvee convoy, and the 4th one was hit. That was about 30 yards in front of me. Five Marines were injured in that, 2 of them fairly seriously.
What's also compelling is that these violent attacks weren't the norm for this unit. In fact, we read your writing, you know, they felt they were making real headway in the town, and this kind of violence, they just hadn't seen this kind of violence.
These 2 attacks were pretty hard for this unit to take. Both attacks affected Charlie Company of the 22nd Marine Expeditionary Unit. Charlie Company is a unit of about 200 men that's responsible for doing most of the patrols in this town of Heat in western Iraq. They hadn't suffered a single casualty during their 2 months in the country.
No injuries at all.
Not a single one. Not a single wounded. And so everybody was really talking about, you know, what liberty ports that they'd get to visit in the Mediterranean in the few days that I was there. And they seemed pretty excited to be going home and felt that they had accomplished a lot. The company commander of Charlie said that attacks had dropped from about 18 a week when he came in late December to about 4 a week when I arrived. And so he was very positive about the situation there. But you know, obviously these attacks kind of changed the complexion of the situation.
Well, in fact, do they think that one of the reasons for the attacks is that they were making some headway with the people in the town?
Yeah, actually, that's what the commander of the 22nd Marines told me. His name's Colonel Frank McKenzie, and he said he considered the attacks a sign of desperation on the part of the insurgents, that they have to continue to seem relevant even when they seem to be losing ground in the city.
This Colonel McKenzie from Birmingham, Alabama, he's an interesting character. Tell us more about him and his feeling toward the military and some of the approach of the military towards war and his own approach.
Colonel McKenzie is a man after my own heart because he studied ancient history, which is something that I'm actually quite interested in myself. And we started with a conversation about that, and it also came out that he's also the kind of guy who reads, you know, the New Yorker magazine, and he's got a very old-fashioned way of looking at war fighting. He calls all these arcane theories of modern war, like fourth-generation warfare, he calls them elegant irrelevance. And he believes that the best way to go about combating the insurgency is really just to walk the streets, to look the residents in the eye, and see what they're feeling by talking to them and just noting what you see around you.
And how did you see them react to him?
I went on a couple patrols with them. One of them was with McKenzie, and the children were very enthusiastic to see the Marines because they knew that the Marines were the gravy train. They were bringing candy and chocolates, and sometimes they even bring soccer balls for some of the kids. But the adults were definitely far more reserved. You see a lot of young men out in the street. They're dressed very conservatively in gray dishdashes, which is a kind of dress almost, and they would stare at the Marines as if they were an occupying army, which they are. But occasionally what would happen would be that the Marines would wave at them or give them a greeting, sometimes in Arabic, and these men would slowly kind of nod or wave themselves, and some of them would even break into a smile. So, you know, it's definitely kind of a tense relationship, but one that may be grounded in respect.
And, you know, he was saying he didn't want any more than that. He's not looking for them to love him. And some of the techniques he employed seemed to make sense. Instead of kicking in a door for a house inspection, knocking on the door, instead of spray painting the walls of a house once it was, you know, inspected, just leaving?
He basically believed that you need to be very respectful of the people in the city because, you know, by detaining a person for a long time, for example, or just detaining them on you know, just this, the hint of a suspicion, you're just making enemies that way. And he explained that to me several times, that he thought that, you know, by showing respect to the residents of Heat, he would be taking away the insurgents' hopes of having support in that city.
Yeah. But then in the end, towards the end of their tour, this devastating blow, three Marines killed in one roadside bomb, perhaps, and five others injured in another attack. How hard was it for these Marines to hold on to that game plan of being respectful and courteous?
It's got to be really hard. You know, I mean, after the first attack where a couple of Marines were wounded, I mean, I spoke to their squad leader, and he was extremely agitated, you know, very upset. He said that the next day he'd be, you know, killing lots of Hajis.
That's the word for insurgents.
Yeah, that's the word for insurgents. It's kind of a slur, and he's just discouraged. But anyway, the next day he said that they hadn't taken it personally and that they were just going to keep on doing their job. And I got the same response from the commander of Charlie Company and also from McKenzie himself. He seemed to think that the best thing to do is to go on with their patrols, to not give in to the anger that they believe the insurgents are trying to provoke. As McKenzie explained to me, these attacks aim at creating, you know, a kind of strategic effect, which is getting the Marines to overreact, getting them to shoot civilians, and by doing that, you know, ensuring that the insurgents will continue to have support in Heat. And he thinks that the best way to avert that is to just keep doing what they're doing and walking the town on foot.
Nelson Hernandez, he's a reporter for The Washington Post and was embedded with the 22nd Marine Expeditionary Unit in Heat in Iraq, a unit which recently suffered several casualties and deaths. Nelson spoke to us from Baghdad. You're listening to Here and Now. A recent study seems to back up the belief researchers have long held that the ability to selectively choose abortions is responsible for the decline in the ratio of girls to boys in India. The study in the British medical journal The Lancet claims as many as 10 million female fetuses may have been aborted in India in the last two decades since the advent of the sonogram. Professor Prabhat Jha co-wrote the study. He's director for the Center for Global Health Research at the University of Toronto. We spoke to him, however, on a somewhat shaky phone line from Bangalore, India, and asked him first how he came up with the number of 10 million female fetuses selectively aborted in the last 20 years.
We conducted a study of 1 million homes that have been followed by the government of India and studied all the births that occurred in 1997, which is about 135,000 births, and looked at the patterns of males and females as second children following a first child. So normally you expect the second child to be equally likely to be male or female, but what we find is that there's a 30% gap in second girls following a first girl, but no gap if it's a first boy. And the only plausible explanation for that is use of ultrasound and selective abortion. And we were able to estimate that conservatively about 500,000 female fetuses are aborted a year. And if that practice has been common over the last two decades, then roughly 10 million female fetuses have been aborted before birth.
But doctor, as you know, critics, including the Indian Medical Association, say your conclusions are too sweeping and that this practice of selective abortion has been curtailed since selective abortion became illegal in India. Doctors are not allowed, they're banned by law, from telling parents the sex of a fetus. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, I think the Indian Medical Association criticism was not backed up with any hard evidence that if you, in fact, look at the sex ratios, they have declined further since 1997 when the study was conducted. In fact, the decline has been twice as fast in urban areas versus rural, and that the only plausible explanation for that is increasing access to ultrasound. So we think that 0.5 million figure a year is a conservative estimate. It's been carefully done, rigorously peer-reviewed in The Lancet, and we find this gap in second females, common in all of India, but certainly worst in particular northern states. And we find that gap in second females or missing females is twice as large in those that have education beyond grade 10 versus illiterate women. And that again points very much to use of ultrasound.
Why would parents in India choose to abort girls? We know this has long been an issue in other countries. China comes to mind. But what are the issues in India?
The reasons are complex and they're cultural. For example, we find that there's no difference by religion, that the gap in second females is as common among Hindu or Muslim or Christian, and it is, as mentioned, steeper in those that are more highly educated. I think it really reflects strong cultural preference for boys. It reflects some issues about inheritance laws. It reflects the desire to carry on family name. And it reflects, to some extent, families ensuring that they have at least one boy. So the reasons for it are complex, but it is certainly widespread. And if you have anything that's even a small change that is so widespread in a population of a billion where 28 million births occur a year, then it's bound to have a dramatic long-term impact on the sex ratios and the number of females and males in the population.
Professor Prabhat Jha is director of the Center for Global Health Research at St. Michael's Hospital, University of Toronto. He's also co-author of the study looking at selective sex abortion, or feticide, the abortion of female fetuses in India. He's speaking to us from Bangalore. Professor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, stay with us. Author Jay McInerney's next. You're listening to Here and Now. now. He published the blockbuster Bright Lights, Big City while still in grad school. Then, as author Jay McInerney recently told the New York Times, he became one of the decadent Manhattan characters in his novel, a coke-snorting, model-izing, nightclubbing bad boy, to be exact. Well, now, after three marriages and a long bout with writer's block, McInerney's back with The Good Life, a post-9/11 novel about two elite New Yorkers with unfaithful partners, kids in Jacquardi designer clothing, summers in the Hamptons, who find themselves falling in love in a makeshift soup kitchen near Ground Zero. Two bordering on shallow characters in search of personal redemption, and perhaps some redemption for their author as well. Jay McInerney joins us in our studios. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
Are you sorry you did that interview with the New York Times style section?
No, I think it's best to best to acknowledge the reality and the persona, you know, which long ago ceased to reflect my own reality, but I think it's important to bring it out in the open in order to exorcise it.
Well, I'm wondering if the book is a part of that exorcism.
Well, indeed it is. In many ways I feel this is my first adult novel, and you know, for someone who just recently passed 50, that's an odd thing to say, but you know, there comes a point after you know, even though I had a very protracted adolescence, you know, when you pass 40, when you have children, you know, when some of your role models have already been long since dead, you know, I'm thinking of people like Scott Fitzgerald and Dylan Thomas, you know, then it's time to kind of rethink your position as a writer, not to mention, you know, your life. And you mentioned this writer's blog. It was a struggle for me to kind of reimagine myself.
Right. Or as a friend of mine recently said, I'm not cute anymore, am I? And, you know, I mean, you know, you mentioned F. Scott Fitzgerald and Dylan Thomas. They may have been role models. You also compared to them, but it's somewhat unfair because, as you said, they could be romanticized because they died.
Well, yeah, and in fact, you know, the funny thing was that I never really thought beyond that. You know?
Right. What do you
when
do?
When I was 28 years old, I just sort of thought, you know, Scott Fitzgerald or Byron were perfectly excellent role models, And the fact is I've outlived both of them, and suddenly I was faced with a kind of a quandary, and I had to think of a new way to write, essentially.
Yeah.
I had to think of a way to be speaking from a point of view of a mature middle-aged man.
Right. Well, the book, the novel that you've written follows Corrine, who lives in a Tribeca loft with her husband, Russell, a book publisher. They're twins. She's trying to revive her career by writing a screenplay of Graham Greene's The Heart of the Matter, while maintaining, you know, her family, her marriage. So, Jay McInerney, what are you saying about these New Yorkers, given what you've said about yourself, trying to adjust to suddenly having kids and it's no longer cute, you know, to have a club life as well?
Well, I think, you know, in some ways the dilemmas of my characters reflects my own. And in fact, you know, September 11th was a real turning point for me. I was struggling with actually with a couple of sort of nascent novels, and I was having a tough time in my personal life. I was, you know, just recovering from a pretty serious case of depression, and then 9/11 came along and knocked me sideways. Being on the ground in New York City, there was a kind of shell shock. There was a lot of reevaluation going on and a lot of reinvention. Everybody asked themselves, you know, what they were doing with their life, what they wanted to do with their life, and who they wanted to wake up next to if another plane hit.
Right. And suddenly the fact that Salman Rushdie may not come to your dinner party is not as important.
Indeed.
You sound like you know these people and you like these people.
I know these people intimately, and I do like them. And Russell and Corrine in particular, I think, are a representative couple in that they live at the edge of this very glamorous world, but they just barely have a toehold in it.
And there's another couple we haven't even mentioned. That's Sasha and Luke, who, boy, they live on the
these
high end.
Yeah, now these people do live on the high
right,
end.
Right, they really...
In fact, I think it's important to say that, you know, one of the things that intrigues me about people like this is that really they run New York and essentially they run the economy of the country. Luke is a Wall Street guy, an investment banker, and all of these things that I like about the city, the museums, the art galleries, the clubs, the restaurants, everything else is actually floating on this vast reservoir of money generated by Wall Street. And I think it's important to understand these people. And I'm curious to know what makes them tick.
As we said, half of each couple has an affair. They meet at a volunteer soup kitchen just after the towers came down.
Mm-hmm.
And just after 9/11, you wrote in The Guardian about a soup kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the soup kitchen in the book is essentially the one that I worked at for a couple of months after 9/11. Like everyone, I was trying to do my little part.
You wrote at the time in The Guardian, the unspoken dirty secret of each new volunteer at the soup kitchen is that we want to see it. We want to help. We want to do something to feel less helpless, less useless, to be able to say in the future that we've done something to earn it.
Yeah. You know, one of the reasons that I had to wait to write this book was because there's a kind of politically correct take on 9/11. We were all noble and selfless at that moment. I mean, the fact is, life is never that simple, even in a moment of extreme crisis. Motives are always mixed. And you know, even in their moment of glory, New Yorkers did not act entirely out of character. And, you know, I've been waiting for people to really come down on me hard about this, but you know, the fact is there was a certain way in which getting down to Ground Zero was a little like getting into the latest restaurant or club. I mean, I don't want to overdo this. As I say, motives are mixed, but some fraction of their pre-9/11 selves was still operative in the way that they responded to this event.
But I'm also reading that paragraph and knowing that it's written by Jay McInerney. We want to have that sense that we've done something to earn it. Picking that up, incredible poetic license here. I mean, I'm taking license, I know it, and I'm placing that over your life. I want to earn it. I want to have some sense that I deserve this acclaim. I want to have some, is that part of you speaking
well, you know, I suppose it's quite possible. I wasn't conscious of that meaning at the time, but I suppose there's a sense in which I sometimes feel like I'm very lucky in that the bounty in my life came a little easily, and certainly I have to say this book didn't come easily. This was the hardest book. I used to laugh at the idea of writer's block, and then I found myself in the middle of it for a couple of years, and it was excruciating. And insofar as this book represents any kind of accomplishment, I feel like I sweated for it.
Right. Well, and I wonder, given that, if you think with this book you're leaving behind the dinner party part, and maybe, you know, starting at where this book ends.
Well, yeah, yes and no, because I think that this world of, you know, Manhattan and its educated and accomplished classes, you know, I hesitate to say privileged, because I think, you know, these are very hardworking, highly educated, highly intelligent people. It's, you know, I don't think I'm going to suddenly start writing about people who leave all of this to go to the Peace Corps
in
Somalia. I don't think I'm going to leave this milieu behind, because it's my world. And I think that it is as representative of the human condition as Raymond Carver's, you know, Northwestern Trailer Parks or William Faulkner's Yoknapatawpha County in the Mississippi Delta. I mean, not to compare myself to my betters, but I'm saying that you know, pain and redemption and grief and exhilaration and all aspects of the human condition are here in one form or another.
Jay McInerney, his new book is called The Good Life. It's about Manhattan just before and just after the fall of the Twin Towers. Thanks for coming to speak with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.